This is episode 64 of the Renew the Arts podcast. Three word pictures for patrons and artists. Welcome to the Renew the Arts podcast, where we discuss the role of art and creativity in the church and in the world. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. Our motto at Renew the Arts is liberate Christian creativity, and we're doing this through cultivating Christian communities in and through the arts by inspiring art patronage and supporting artists. If you'd like to join our community of monthly donors and contribute to this podcast, please visit renewthearts.org/donate. If you want to join the Porchlight Network and begin your journey into patronage, go to app.porchlight.art and sign up as a host or attender. Welcome back for episode 64 of the Renew the Arts podcast. I'm really thankful for all of you joining me as we come back from our break. This is the beginning of the 2025 season of the Renew the Arts podcast, and we're going to be diving in with a solo podcast with me. We've got some interviews planned for later in the year, and I'm really excited about them. But for today, it's your old friend, and I'm here with three word pictures that I find particularly clarifying in the realm of the arts. So two of these will be more connected to the idea of a consumer or a patron of the arts, and one of them is particularly targeted for artists. They're analogies, metaphors, however you want to read that, that might help you a little bit to understand how we are approaching the arts and how I think the arts would be better approached. So the first of these is an analogy that I like to call space station Christianity. What I mean by this, I started to think about this when I read Kevin Kelly's book Out of Control, which I mentioned in the last episode of this podcast in our mailbag episode, because he is the journalist and editor of Wired who came up with the 1,000 True Fans principle. But he wrote this book, Out of Control, that I mentioned, that I find extremely fascinating. It is filled with all sorts of interesting ideas. And it's mostly about the idea of cybernetics or systems of control. That may seem to you not to be all that interesting, but I promise you, if you get into that book, you will find all sorts of extremely, extremely entertaining and engaging ideas. And one of the things he talks about for some length of time is the difference between biospheres and space stations. So a biosphere, if it's actually shut off from the outside air and environment, is really a space station, or it could be. You could put a biosphere, theoretically, into space, and it would function just as well as it would on Earth, since it's cut off from everything else anyway. And he thinks that the biosphere approach is a different approach than a space station, even fundamentally. So with the space station, what you have is an attempt to figure out what are the absolute minimum requirements for survival. And so you have desiccated foods, and they tried to figure out what percentage of protein, what percentage of carbohydrates, what percentage of sugars or whatever, water is necessary for survival. They figure out what's the percentage of oxygen or nitrogen or whatever in the atmosphere and how to filter that atmosphere so that exhalations are able to be breathed back in. And the space station is basically just trying to figure out that from on the basis of essential utility, what is going to provide the fundamental, necessary, required elements of survival for the people who are going to be living in it. And there's a story he tells because he interviews a man who actually worked on biospheres here on Earth. And that guy talks about a woman he knew who was among a list of people invited to meet the astronauts who had just returned on a space shuttle from the space station. And she was really excited, and she gets up there to the walkway, and the astronauts come out the door from the space station, and she says she was so overwhelmed by the foulness of their smell that she ended up throwing up off the side of the walkway right after meeting them, very embarrassed. She was very embarrassed about that. And yet it was involuntary. It was just, they smelled so bad because they had been sitting in their own stale air in this extremely unflourishing and uninhabitable environment. And it was barely enough to survive. But with a lot of astronauts coming back, it's not really much. I mean, it's not sustainable. You have atrophy of muscles, you have sickness and an increase of toxicity and all these kinds of things, because even with the best filtration and the best nutrition you can try to get that's actually able to be shipped up there in the space station, it's just barely the building blocks of survival. It is definitely not a life of flourishing. And in pretty good contrast to that, Kevin Kelly mentions that a biosphere, they basically throw as much biodiversity and real life into a biosphere as they possibly can. They have soil-based organisms that are filtering the air. The air is being pumped through the soil back up into the air. And there's algae and other kinds of plants, edible plants and fish. And they try and have as many different biomes inside the biosphere that can be sustained. And what they find is the more things they throw in there to get it closer and closer to being like Earth, the more there becomes a sustainable synergy between all the various different life forms. They begin to depend on each other. They build a structure that actually functions of life within there. And they've actually done this. They did it with a biosphere. I think it was in Arizona. Kevin Kelly writes about it. You can read about it in the book. But it was 8 people who lived there. They were inside this sealed off biosphere for about 8 months, which is longer than the 6 months that they usually have astronauts on the space station. And all of the 8 people, I mean, you can't really call them astronauts, but they could have been. This biosphere could have been in space. It was cut off entirely from the air system and the life system of the rest of the Earth. And the 8 people that came out of there were healthier, happier, and more productive than they had been when they went in. In fact, a lot of them didn't want to leave the biosphere. And it was because they had been farming their own food and the water was being filtered in a natural way. The air was being filtered in a natural way. It was pretty close to being a semi-Edenic kind of environment. And they all loved it and were very healthy there. And when you compare those two things, you realize Earth really is a biosphere of sorts. The life that we have here, the essential elements that God considered necessary for sustainable life, and again, his intention was not that life should be sustained for only 70 or 80 years, but that the conditions for life on Earth would be able to support life indefinitely. Meaning if we had never fallen and we were not sinful and we didn't die, we could live forever. And Earth is a place where you could live forever. A space station is not a place where you could live forever. And we shouldn't be using, I don't think, that kind of thinking in our consideration of what kind of life and how we want to shape life, the way we want to lead life, what kind of life we want. We should not be using the space station model. We should be using more the Earth biosphere model for what actually makes the essential building blocks of a life worth living. The reason this struck me is because I feel like a lot of Christians view the arts in those terms, as if because the arts are not part of the necessary or the essential building blocks of mere survival or subsistence, a lot of people end up saying things like artists should get real jobs, or art has no real utility, or art is not essential to life. And I wonder, what are we aiming for if bare subsistence or bare existence is what we're actually trying to accomplish within the church? The reality is that Jesus says that he came that we might have life, and life abundantly, not merely subsistence, but a flourishing. And I think in this sense, art is essential to the mission of the church, because the church is not just about perpetuating existence, but rather teaching a way of life that is filled with grace and that is filled with abundance. And God didn't call us merely to space station subsistence, but to heaven coming to earth life. So I want you to consider your own relationship to the arts and beauty. Good art directs us to pause in the beautiful and in the profound, to luxuriate in the profound grace of God's gift of life and goodness. art returns some of that flesh and spirit of meaning and fulfillment back to our desiccated and languishing bare bones. Are you flourishing? Are you enjoying your life? Are you filled with hope in the goodness of God? Or are you just barely surviving in the bare existence of chain links of income-producing but unfulfilling tasks punctuated by passing amusements and distractions? Well, perhaps, if that's your experience, you need to exit your space station and take some rest days here on the Earth. The Renew the Arts podcast is doing our mailbag episode a bit differently in 2025. We're going to start collecting mailbag questions now for the mailbag episode coming in December. So if you have questions, objections, or comments about this episode or about arts and faith in general, go ahead and send those questions to us. Go to renewthearts.org/mailbag to submit your questions or comments. Again, that's renewthearts.org/mailbag. All right, here's another one. So this one I like to call probiotic versus antibiotic culture. If you've watched the Netflix series Cooked, which I highly recommend, it's also very fascinating, you will see that in one of the episodes where it talks about fermentation, they interview a nun whose name is Mother Noella Marcellino. And she's this fascinating woman. I really do recommend, if you don't watch any other part of that series, that you watch this part of it, because she is really wonderful. And she's a cheesemaker for a, I don't know, what do you call it? Do we still call it a nunnery? Anyway, she is a cheesemaker for a convent in Connecticut. And she apparently had a major issue because she was making cheese in the old-fashioned way in wooden barrels. This was passed down for many generations from French cheese-making practices, and they would use these wooden barrels, and they would keep these wooden barrels, which would become inoculated with these particular biotics. And those biotics are what produce the cheese over time when you put the milk in them and you ferment them and you culture them. And apparently the state of Connecticut didn't like this. They came in order to check their facility to make sure that they were allowed to sell their cheese. And they said, oof, no, you can't use these wooden barrels. That is absolutely not kosher. It's not sterile. We're not going to approve you to sell this cheese to the public unless you use more sterile stainless steel containers in order to culture your cheese. So they actually did try to do this for a period of time. And Noella tells the story about how they had these stainless steel containers and it just wasn't producing the same quality of cheese. So she challenged the state of Connecticut's Food Safety Administration, but she didn't have evidences to prove that it was actually the case that these wooden barrels were safe. She ended up getting involved in a scholarship program where eventually she earned a doctorate, a PhD in microbiology, and her thesis ended up being on cheesemaking and the cultures that are involved in that cheesemaking. And she actually proved scientifically that the wooden barrels made for a safer environment for the production of cheese than stainless steel. And she showed this by actually introducing E. coli into these wooden barrels in the cheesemaking process. And she introduced a small amount of E. coli also into stainless steel containers for the making of this same cheese. And what she found is that over time, in a very short period of time, the probiotic culture in these wooden barrels actually outcompeted and destroyed the E. coli population, so that even though they spiked at first for a short period of time, they actually eventually ended up being eliminated in the wooden barrels, whereas they actually thrived in the sterile environment of the stainless steel culture. And you can see this in lots of other environments as well. And in fact, if you think about the strongest and most powerful quote-unquote superbugs that we have produced, most of them have been produced in sterile environments, because in sterile environments, there's no competition to put down those very strongest of bugs that are able to survive, you know, after the Lysol has killed 99.99999% of them and only the strongest one have survived, and they don't have any competition at that point, and they end up thriving in that vacuum. Well, I think this is a really great analogy for the difference between culture war and culture care. You've probably heard us talk about that in the past. It was sort of an idea that Makoto Fujimura, I think, was most instrumental in establishing. But it's this idea that culture war, which is almost like the antibiotic approach, is this attempt to destroy and to break down any potential dangerous feelings, emotions, propagandas, truths, ideas in the world, as if there must be this conflict to break them out, to destroy them, to remove them from your culture. Whereas what he says is that culture is more of a cultivated, as you might imagine from the word culture, process where through care and nurturing, you actually create an environment where the positive and the growth-inducing and the flourishing of that community is more provided for. And I think that if you look at, you know, Noella Marcelino's work with cheese, you can see a similar thing happening, that it's not always the case that destroying what you think is bad and using these extremely coercive mechanisms to do that and creating a quote-unquote sterile environment where no feelings can exist, where no things that you think are dangerous might exist, that doesn't always produce the best outcome, because it creates an environment where anything really can flourish if it ends up coming in to that sterile environment. Instead, I think that our approach to the arts is more of a probiotic solution to those same problems. So I'm not saying that there isn't a problem of emotionalism or negative emotions or the uncertainty of affections or anything like that. I'm not saying there's not a problem with those things. There is a problem with those things, and we've seen some of the effects of those problems. The issue is that saying, since a lot of emotions can be unstable and might destabilize an environment, then we really need to just remove emotions and also emotional people from the decision-making process. Instead, what a probiotic solution would be is, why don't we cultivate proper emotions and actually have a place where we're nurturing the right kinds of feelings and the right kinds of loves, and those greater loves will actually have a greater capacity of removing and reducing the negative consequences of bad loves or bad tastes. So if tastes can be dangerous and manipulative, which I agree it can be, the solution is not to remove the issue of taste and try to nuke it with your antibiotic solution and your sterile environments, but instead to actually produce a culture that is so dedicated and so filled with life-giving and life-oriented tastes and loves that those evil loves, those destructive things, just can't survive. They're just not able to outcompete the large populations of great, wonderful feelings and of loving, life-giving, nurtured beauties. That's what I recommend within the arts. Produce good things more than you try to destroy bad things. And you'll find in the end that those bad things just don't have the same ability to coexist. This will probably end up being somewhat of a short episode, but I do recommend that you take some time to meditate on what I'm talking about today, because I think that it will be somewhat helpful to you to consider these things in these terms and see how you might be able to approach the arts in a clearer and bolder and more dedicated fashion because of these. To do our vital work, Renew the Arts depends on voluntary support from dedicated patrons like you. We would love if you partnered with us financially at renewthearts.org/donate. Another great thing you can do for us right now is leave a rating and review wherever you are listening to this podcast. That helps other people discover our podcast and our work. Thank you so much for listening and partnering with us. We greatly appreciate it. My last of the three word pictures for today is called Miniature for Scale, and it's a word picture for artists that I hope is helpful to them to pursue their art in a way that I think is most productive. So if you've watched any of the behind-the-scenes footage of the making of The Lord of the Rings or any other movie that has a grand and epic scale, you'll find that in order to create a realistic but grand spectacle, oftentimes artists will resort to miniatures. So for instance, if you think about those really huge sweeping visions of Minas Tirith, that where you're seeing them from the air and whatnot, that was actually created with a pretty large but still miniature two-scale model of Minas Tirith that Peter Jackson and his team built. And you can see pictures of them standing next to it, and you know, they're nearly as tall as the city. And the reason they decided to build these miniatures is because it would have been really difficult for them to build a full-scale version of Minas Tirith. And so they ended up resorting to miniatures in order to create the same scale and the same detail. And they just used the camera and kind of zooming in on that scale in order for it to look as large as life. And the problem I see with a lot of art that I find, especially with Christian art, is that we're trying to talk about things that are so humongous, they're actually larger than life. They're just huge concepts and huge ideas, and just the very nature and person of God is so very far beyond us that oftentimes when you're reaching for something so humongous and so huge, it feels kind of impossible, and it oftentimes we come up short. So what I recommend is a sort of approach to those huge ideas that's similar to the miniature for scale. And I think that God has built the miniature for scale concept into the way he represents and reveals himself in nature and in our lived and sensed experience. Because those small, small things in reality actually speak better of those huge, huge things that he's trying to tell us than he would have been able to tell us if he had tried to tell us at scale. And if you think about it like this, sometimes when we're talking about the hugeness of God's grace, we don't have any real capacity to do it at scale, but we still oftentimes will try, and what we end up doing is talking in generalities and in abstractions. You're so great, you're so great, you're so great. And we think if we just repeat that enough times, that maybe we'll get to the size we're looking for of the greatness of God. And that's not really the approach that he takes. And I think that in fiction and in art especially, you really have to take the miniature for scale approach in order to do any justice to the hugeness of the things that you're dealing with. And let me give you some advice from Flannery O'Connor. I'll quote from her book, Mystery and Manners. In that book, she has an essay called The Nature and Aim of Fiction, which I think should be required reading for any Christian artist of any kind. But there's a really excellent section of this essay that I'm going to quote from right now. She says, "The Manichaeans separated spirit and matter." So let me stop right there. The Manichaeans were a philosophical movement. Augustine was actually part of them for a period of time. They were very much influenced by Platonism, and they believed that the material world and the physical things were bad, base, lowly, and that the spiritual realm and the pure realm of the spirit was high and lofty and good. They separated those two things, and they said body bad, soul good. All right, so let me go back to the quote. "The Manichaeans separated spirit and matter. To them, all material things were evil. They sought pure spirit and tried to approach the infinite directly without any mediation of matter. This is also pretty much the modern spirit, and for the sensibility infected with it, fiction is hard, if not impossible, to write, because fiction is so very much an incarnational art. One of the most common and saddest spectacles is that of a person of really fine sensibility and acute psychological perception trying to write fiction by using these qualities alone. This type of writer will put down one intensely emotional or keenly perceptive sentence after the other, and the result will be complete dullness. The fact is that the materials of the fiction writer are the humblest. Fiction is about everything human, and we are made out of dust. And if you scorn getting yourself dusty, then you shouldn't try to write fiction. It's not a grand enough job for you." I love those last lines. It's not a grand enough job for you to write fiction if you're not willing to get a little dirty, a little dusty, willing really to get a little miniature. And that's one of the things I think is so helpful about this particular analogy, is in this very counterintuitive way, when you're able to drill down to the details, to the very small details of reality, you're actually able to better encapsulate and better represent the hugeness of all the spiritual realities that are in many ways beyond us and beyond our senses. And oftentimes, the humility of the artist is getting down into those miniature spaces, and through the discussion and the explanation and the description of all of those details, actually able somehow to make that jump from that miniature to the at least impression of the full-scale model that he would never be able to build in his wildest dreams because he doesn't have it in his capacity to do it. And so if you're an artist and you're listening to this, I hope that you'll take this to heart. And the next song that you write, when you have those really big feelings, really, really big ideas that you're wanting to tackle, start really small and use your miniature for scale. All right, well, that's what I've got for today. And I know that was a fairly short episode, but I hope it was still filled with some richness for you. And maybe if you spend some time and think about those things, think about how they might apply to your life and how they might change your relationship to the arts and even the way that you cultivate beauty and life in your own house and in your own community. And it is also the case that a lot of the episodes, I just want to let you know, for this season are going to have to do with this idea of flourishing and the importance of beauty and the arts in a flourishing life, not merely subsistence, not merely existence, but truly life. So we'll be talking a little bit more about that stuff and stuff that's applying to it or connected to it. And I hope that you're looking forward to that. And I also wanted to let you know there's a slight change in the format of the podcast. I am not going to feel like I need to finish every podcast with a song. This episode, I thought about not having a song, but since it's a fairly short episode already, I'm going to add a song to the end of this. And it is a new track that was just released. It was sponsored by Renew the Arts for a band that you are familiar with probably already, the band Warbler. They produced a few records. They have produced three records. Sean Sullivan is the main singer-songwriter for that group, and he has friends that do session work with him for each record, including myself, as we have talked about the record Wrestling, which we released and supported and produced, and we had a long conversation about that in a couple of seasons ago. And he just released a single called America with an exclamation point. And you can find that everywhere, Spotify, Bandcamp, Amazon Music, Apple Music, whatever you go to listen to music on, you'll find it out there. And it is a great single, and it has a B-side called Brother Please that I think is a beautiful picture of at least a spirit that desires a community of cultivation and of nurturing, and a community where there is that probiotic and not antibiotic culture. So I'm going to play that for the end of this episode. And I do recommend that you listen to both tracks. The first one is very different than this one, but this will give you some idea of the spirit of the artist. Thank you very much and enjoy. This is Brother Please by Warbler from the single America. Persuade you.
other.